Think is made possible by Guaranty Bank, Perot Systems, Southwest Securities, and the Executive Education Center at the University of Texas at Dallas.
Welcome to Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. How do electronic technologies change the way artists interpret the world? You'll be able to see for yourself over the next few Saturday nights when the Video Association of Dallas exhibits video and other media-based art exhibitions at Conduit Gallery. But don't let the word video fool you. These are not the sort of works you will find by channel surfing.
Please stop. Do I have to stay in here forever?
I don't want to talk about it right now.
Oh, Lisa.
I don't want to talk about it right now.
That was a sample of A Family Finds Entertainment, one of dozens of works featured in the video art exhibition series, The Program, coordinated by the Video Association of Dallas. Curators Charles D. Mitchell and Carolyn Sorter are here to talk about it. D. Carolyn, welcome to Think.
Thanks for having me.
Where is the line between narrative video and video art?
There's no consensus about that at all, as far as I know. It's basically just what did the artist intend in terms of where they want it to be shown, and then everybody else has to sort of agree, yeah, we'll show it there, or no, they won't. And I don't think there is a clear definition.
I think some of the things we're showing are literally made, at the kitchen table. Other things are produced like an independent film. You would expect to see it at Sundance, and it's an hour long. But again, the audience, I think it's mostly where they perceive their audience being.
So video art lives in a gallery.
It lives in a gallery or a museum. You're not going to see it at the multiplex. Mm-hmm. And often, although the things we're showing are single channel projections, often they're narratives or documentaries, but they involve three or four screens going at one time, which is another aspect of it.
And in fact, there are a lot of, and I'm not sure how many you have in the show, but there are sculptural installations as well, where the space around the art itself is also part of the work.
Sort of. Probably the piece we just saw is interesting in that way because one of the artist's requirements was that there has to be a couch. We can show it any way we want as long as there's a couch. So that's one of the installations.
Mm-hmm. And I have to imagine that new technology, the screens getting lighter and thinner and sort of more portable, must open up some interesting opportunities as well.
Absolutely, because a lot of artists, and I can't say we really have that represented in this show, but I mean, I've seen artworks with videos on a screen this big, intended to be this big. For example, one piece I saw in the last year had a whole, the interior, kind of a doll's house size interior with a little video on the TV, and that was part of it. But another thing that's important about what's developed in the last 10 years is that it's become so much easier for artists to pick it up and make video and edit it on a laptop or whatever. So there's been a real explosion in the amount of video art being made.
Let's look at another piece, Gas Zappers by Kenneth Tin Kin Hung. An interesting bit of animation there. Clearly we hear in the audio in particular the influence of video gaming.
Mm-hmm. Right.
What kind of background do many of these artists bring with them?
there's a lot of video gaming involved, because I know Carol and I both tended not to understand certain things until they were explained to us that it involved gaming technology. The Tin Can, though, is a successful commercial designer, and also has a gallery practice. The other people have performance art backgrounds, and then other people are really involved with the technology of something like Second Life or the whole virtual
online
world
kind
like
of
that.
Gaming.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So it sounds like it's pretty common for them to move back and forth from one medium to video and then back to another medium.
Well, I think a lot of the young artists have just grown up completely immersed in so many different technologies,
absolutely.
And they are pretty, you know, able to move back and forth that way. And but there, we have work in the show that basically involves hacking video games and repurposing them, and those are interesting pieces. And I'm, you know, I used to say video art to me seemed like the most powerful art medium ever invented. But now it's the virtual reality. It's, you can see on the horizon that maybe that's where we're going to really end up, and that's very exciting.
Yeah, I was going to ask if it was common to use montages or clips from other works, but I guess it comes more from video than from television or film. Is that the case?
All sources,
yeah,
I would say.
I think it's pretty much open season on found footage. In fact, one of the things we're showing is an artist who simply presents 12 minutes of found footage. You know, it's unedited. It's like a ready-made in that sense, you know, that he just found it and he's showing it as art.
Anaconda Target.
Anaconda Target.
Yeah, it's actually footage that was shot from a bomber, a U.S. bomber over Iraq, and he somehow got hold of this footage and has edited it, I'm sure, to figure out where to start and stop, but that's really what it involves, and you get to hear the soundtrack of the guys discussing what they're bombing and all of that.
How much do our expectations of the conventions of what video is, which come mostly, I guess, from watching television, how much do those affect the way we perceive video art?
I think that the artists, especially the younger artists that we're showing, are so at home with television, and they know those conventions so well that they really know how to play with them. I mean, again, somebody that we're showing, Matt Morello, has a series of sitcoms where he's taken clips from Beverly Hillbillies and Bewitched and Hogan's Heroes and inserted himself as a famous Western philosopher and engages the characters. And so there's a lot of sort of subverting of the expectation of commercial television, I think, that goes on.
Mm-hmm. It's also very clear these artists have become very sophisticated in their ability to kind of see through the, you know, increasingly polished surfaces that are being presented to them, and I think some of them are actually interested in going back to a more, you know, kitchen table production value, partly to kind of jab that, you know, to say it's really the substance that counts or whatever, you know. I mean, there's various takes you can, depending how they're using it, but
we have the perfect example of that. I think we have the dating game. Let's take a look at that.
Great.
Hello, dear. So, welcome to the dating game. I understand that you're from around here. Whereabouts exactly are you from? Are you from Southern California, or whereabouts?
Los Angeles.
Fascinating. Absolutely fascinating.
Thank you.
All right, are you ready to play the dating game? Before we get going, we're going to take a second and go over it. Introduce ourselves to our fine bachelors.
So, deliberately low production values.
Very low production values in that game.
And obviously that was the choice, because technology is available, and they could have done more than hot dogs on a stick.
Yeah, I mean, at some points you can see the guy's hand moving the stick, so.
But John Pilipchuk, who made that piece, he is definitely a painter and a sculptor, and the video project, I think, he was sitting around one day and thought it would be fun to do it. And to my knowledge, the three videos we're showing are the extent of his video work to date as well.
How challenging is it for video artists to actually sell their works?
Challenging.
Yeah.
You know, they have to provide, a lot of collectors, one of the big resistance points over the years has been that it can be copied so easily. So, a lot of the collectors were resistant, and artists generally provide some kind of certificate that goes with it that says this is limited edition and this is the authentic thing that you're really getting, and that's really all anybody has to go on. But honestly, I mean, I own video art, and I think people should take it more seriously. And I think we've reached kind of a tipping point that people are starting to realize it's here to stay. Their favorite artists are picking up video cameras, even if they never did video before. Mm-hmm. And so I think that we're getting a lot of attention because of that, hopefully.
Yeah, there's always been institutional support, because that was thought the only, especially when you're dealing with multi-channel presentations,
that it takes multiple screens.
Yeah, it takes an institution almost to do it. But more and more galleries are approaching private collectors about taking this sort of work. And there's always a question about when technology changes. I mean, people who have old VHS tapes of video art, are they supposed to transfer them to DVD now? You know, those are there's regular seminars held at museums about how to handle those questions.
Well, for people maybe who are just being introduced to video art, when you decide that you want to study the history of painting or sculpture, it's really simple to go out and find a book, and you can figure out what the canon is, and you can go to it. What do you recommend to people who want to know about video art and sort of get caught up to where we are now? Where in the world do they go?
That's really why I started curating, because it's so hard to get to see this stuff. Even if you went to New York, and you'd have to make appointments at, you know, 20 galleries or more, and schlep all over town, so by curating, you get to see a lot. There aren't very many places you can go to see a concentration of it, and I'm not saying that just to, you know, promote our series. It really is a unique opportunity, I think, or at least certainly for this part of the country.
You've got 50 works.
We've got over 50 works by over 40 artists.
And almost all of them are premieres to Texas. I mean, artists who have never been shown in Texas.
Right, and they're almost all internationally recognized. So it is hard to see it. I co-curated with Danette Dufalo a series last summer out of the Video Association archives. So that was kind of everybody's chance to maybe catch up a little bit on 20 years of video art history. And then another thing you can do is, like, there's an organization in New York called Electronic Arts Intermix, and if you book far enough in advance, anybody can go to their screening room and look at stuff in their collection. So, but other than that, you really have to just try to catch events like these.
Sort of figure out what you've missed and go to.
Yeah. There are certainly books available in the history of video art, but they're much even more unsatisfying than history of painting books, because you really don't get a sense.
You can't see
of
the work.
Yeah, mm-hmm. You're only seeing static images all the time.
Well, maybe that leads to the next question, which is, this used to be part of the video festival, and now it's sort of a discrete branch. Can you talk about that decision?
I know as much as probably 10 years ago, Bart would occasionally ask me if I had anything to recommend for the video festival, and we would get, you know, again, if you ask, it's surprising what you can get if you ask, you know. And so we had Paul McCarthy in one exhibition, Pipilotti Wrist. I mean, these are people, they were younger 10 or 15 years ago than they are now, but also they would show in the midst of a four-day marathon with four venues going simultaneously and 250 screenings, and things would tend to get lost. And I think what Carolyn did last year with the retrospective of the video art portion of the festival sort of led to this.
Yeah, because we just found it was just a lot easier for people who are interested in it to find it and to focus on it and realize they needed to get there. So we had a huge turnout. So we were... You know, that kind of gave everybody the idea that maybe we should just try this and see if it works.
Mm-hmm. Well, it makes sense that you really need to focus on this if this is what you want to do, as opposed to, it would seem like if it was right next to the video festival, then people are sort of rushing to a screening they plan to see, as opposed to sort of checking out these very short pieces.
Well, another good thing about what we're doing this year, too, with the old festival, if you missed something, you were out of luck. Whereas what we've done this year is anything that opened on a Saturday night is available to be viewed through noon Thursday of the remainder of the week. So you've got a few more days to get over and see it.
It's a projection on Saturday night, and then during the week you can see it on a monitor.
That sounds great.
Or the installations.
Great. Carolyn D., thanks so much for coming in.
Absolutely.
You can see the program. It'll screen different works of video art each Saturday night through August 23rd at Conduit Gallery in Dallas. Just ahead on Think, a graffiti artist turns from painting on building walls to showing on gallery walls. First, take a look at this week's arts calendar.
The Art and Seek calendar for this weekend includes countercultural artifacts, Waxahachie happiness, and marital mayhem. Find out what happens when a philandering groom-to-be wakes up next to an attractive unclothed female who's not his fiancée as Theater Arlington kicks off the first full weekend of the farce, Perfect Wedding. On stage at the Bathhouse Cultural Center, the 2008 Festival of Independent Theaters remains in full swing. This weekend's offerings include performances from Wingspan, Act One, Echo Theater, and the Core Performance Manufactory. If you're hankering for a short road trip, head south to Waxahachie for the Webb Gallery's newest exhibit, What Is It? Where'd You Get It? Can I Have It? A showcase of vintage signs and ads, and opening night entertainment from Austin's Golden Boys and Pinky Diablo, the Sewing Cowboy. And Kettle Art in Deep Ellum goes back in time for an exhibit of memorabilia and artifacts from the mid-80s through the early 21st century, including photography, rare posters and artwork from the Gypsy Tea Room, trees, and others. For more about these events, join us at artandseek.org, a new website for the arts in North Texas. For Art and Seek, I'm Jeannie Mascoro.
Does where we see a work of art matter as much as what we see in it? It's an open question for fans of Dallas artist Tony Bones. He started tagging walls with graffiti when he was just a teenager. He's been arrested multiple times for expressing himself unsolicited on other people's property. But his stylized stick figures have earned him at least as many fans as enemies. And critics are so taken with his paintings that he now shows and sells in art galleries, including Dallas's The Public Trust. Tony Bones is here now to talk about his work. Tony, welcome to Think.
Thanks, Chris.
So, to what extent is the art that you do about the image itself, and to what extent is it about really the performance when you're doing graffiti and the sort of act of being out there in a space where you're not permitted?
Well, it's definitely both. I think probably more importantly than anything, to me at least, when I was doing the graffiti, it was more definitely about the act, and the image was secondary. And the image kind of evolved through the act, but it was more about the act, and it was the thing that was, you know, that drove me to do it. More than the image. And now it's funny because now it's kind of more the image. I mean, because it's just, you know, it's just the image now. It's not like a provocative statement or whatever on the street, you know. It's not like illegal. It doesn't hold the same energy, at least to me.
Well, it's interesting about the energy because most of the works that you show in galleries are smaller, much smaller.
Yeah, typically. Yeah, definitely. There's not, the stuff on the street is, I would do it as big as possible.
Spray paint and all that.
Yeah.
Do you, the motion has to be entirely different. I mean, do you feel like it's a completely separate process?
It is and it isn't. I would say it's probably, yeah, separate a lot. It's separated more over time. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So you started tagging when you were a kid, a teenager. At what point did you start to think of yourself as an artist as opposed to just a kid who was out there?
I still think of myself that way. I don't know, it's still really weird to not, I mean, I remember the first time someone asked me to have a show or like considered it. It was exciting, but it always felt really weird. So, I mean, I don't know. I still kind of think of myself, it's weird to think of myself in those terms as, you know, an artist who, I don't know.
So, let's talk about the sites that you chose. And I guess you're not tagging anymore, is that right?
No.
Okay. Did you make that choice because you kept getting arrested or because you decided it was time to do something different?
Yeah, I mean, honestly, it was because I got in trouble and, you know, it was time to do something different. You know, I couldn't, after I got busted, that it was like the main time, there was this one big time, this big graffiti crackdown thing, and it landed me on probation, all these fines and all this stuff. And so I was left with all this idle time. And so I just invested more time into the fine art sort of thing. So.
And did that change the kinds of things that you were drawing and painting?
Not really. I mean, I guess it kind of allowed me more time to organize like more of a narrative in the work, which I always really like to do on the street, but it, you know, at that moment when you're actually standing there on, you know, under a streetlight or whatever, it's hard to put together like a strong narrative or a strong story with, you know, something you're doing. So I guess in that sense, yeah, it's changed it a bit.
Yeah, your figures are very simplistic,
yeah.
And I wonder if some of that comes from the fact that you had to, when you were working on the street, had to work fast.
Yeah, absolutely. Actually, that's exactly where it came from. I was doing, in the beginning, I was doing really simple, more complex characters, emulating a couple styles from some of the older graffiti writers around Dallas, and it kind of had to break it down, you know, broke it down to like its most basic form, like of the human form, and then just kind of built with these really basic elements.
What's really interesting about graffiti, and we'll talk in a minute about the people who owned the property in the first place, but
people pass by bus benches and walls and different places every single day, and they're almost invisible until suddenly there's some image on them that they didn't expect.
Yeah, I think that's interesting that you say that, because certainly with a lot of people, they don't see it. I mean, it's something right in front of your eyes until, you know, someone mentions it, and then all of a sudden it's everywhere. It's like that with a word, you know. You learn a new word, and then all of a sudden you start hearing it everywhere. So it's the same sort of thing. Like, and but with graffiti, it's funny, because once you see one thing, you start seeing, like, all of it. And it kind of, like, opens this whole new city to you. And people, I've gotten it several times. People are like, oh, you know, I saw your thing, and then I started seeing all this, and it's everywhere. This graffiti stuff is just, like, all over the place. And it's so neat. I never noticed before. And a lot of times people's kids will point it out, which I really like. My kid always said he knew what that was, and he would always point out this thing. It's like, there's that little guy again. That always really made me happy for some reason.
Do you feel any remorse or culpability for the people who feel like it was necessary to go repaint those walls and feel like their stuff was damaged?
I mean, yeah. I guess I feel sort of bad. But, I mean, honestly, I never really did it in a spot that looked like people cared that much about it. You know, I definitely wouldn't do it on someone's house or, like, a car or, like, a church or something where someone, you know, cared about, like, and, like, I, you know, no, it was, like, some rusty wall or, like, some crummy overpass where it wasn't, like, going to be hurting, like, somebody. Someone wasn't going to see it and be like, ah, you know, I spent so much time making that wall look like that, or, you know, putting all those rust spots and broken windows. And so, I mean, in that sense, I tried to avoid that as much as possible, because I was conscious of that for sure.
Is it hard for you? You pass the same kinds of walls and broken windows and things like that now. Do you feel that compulsion?
Oh, yeah. It's like an alcoholic, because you're always an alcoholic.
You still want to paint on stuff.
I mean, I still have that compulsion. Yeah, it's definitely there. Absolutely.
And what do you know of the people who buy your work?
What do I know of them?
Yeah.
They range. I mean, I guess it's usually like young kind of people who'd seen the stuff around. But, I mean, it's definitely a wide range of people. I've had, you know, old ladies buy paintings and stuff. I just got commissioned by an older woman to do a piece for her two grandsons. So, I mean, and then I've had, like, little kids come try and buy stuff.
But that's a piece on canvas that was commissioned, right?
Yeah.
Because you're not interested in commissions for people's garage walls.
I mean, not as much. It just kind of feels, it's weird. It kind of feels forced, or if I were to do it outside, like with spray paint or something, I just, I don't know, it wouldn't feel right, you know?
Do you work in other media also?
I don't limit myself. I've done stuff in, like, with metal, like welding and stuff like that, and sculpture, and just, I mean, really anything. I've got this, I'm working on neon signs now, which is like my newest kind of little thing.
How do you learn to work with neon?
I myself don't actually work with it. I like design them and then they're made, but I'm very interested to learn. The guys that are making them said that they would kind of show me the ropes. It's really crazy. I mean, you go in, I went and I saw the place where they make them, and it's just, it's crazy toxic chemicals everywhere, and little old guys bent over, bending these pieces of glass.
Have you ever thought about drawing them?
Drawing the old guys? No, I haven't.
Okay, well, thank you so much for coming in.
Yeah, sure, definitely.
You can see Tony Bone's work at the Public Trust Art Gallery in Dallas from August 9th through September 6th. For free video and audio podcasts of this show, you can go to kera.org/think. If you want to send us an email, the address is think@kera.org. My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for being with us, and have a great week.
Think is made possible in part by Guaranty Bank, using its more than 100 years of business experience to provide financing for small and medium-sized businesses and independent oil and gas producers throughout Texas. By Perot Systems, a technology services company trusted by more than 500 clients worldwide. Perot Systems delivers technology infrastructure services, consulting, application solutions, and business process solutions that enable growth. By Southwest Securities, a nationally recognized regional brokerage firm that's been meeting the needs of Southwest investors for more than 30 years. Southwest Securities is a member of the New York Stock Exchange and SIPC. By the Executive Education Center at the University of Texas at Dallas, providing degree and non-degree programs to help corporate professionals and executives stay ahead. On the web at som.utdallas.edu/executive. And by the valued support of KERA members. Thank you.